The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 145 of The Bugle, the first ever Bugle from Asia. What a momentous day in the history of audio newspapers. I am Andy Zaltzman, and I'm live in Bangalore. Shalom. Do I sound different? That's because I'm much nearer the equator, so my voice doesn't have quite the same angle of entry into the microphone, and I'm on the phone. And not in Asia, but by happy coincidence, dressed exactly like Mahatma Gandhi. It's the Maharaja of Mirth, the Jamsa Heap of Jokes, the Nawab of Nice Quips. It's John Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. Well, this is very exciting. I mean, it's our first Bangalore Bugle. And, it's great even to say that. It's not just the alliteration, it's the geographical location involved. This is a huge amount of technological effort for the bullshit that we're about to spew. So, Andy, you've been living the life of a 19th century British explorer over the last couple of weeks. You've already been in Dubai, Delhi, and now Bangalore. How was Dubai? Did you see any stupid buildings there?
I did see the stupid buildings. I'll talk more about them later, but I can confirm that they lived up to all expectations. They were unbelievably stupid.
That's very exciting. Now, obviously, Andy, the desire for empire is an addiction in itself. You never truly lose the desire to do it. You just become better at managing the urges.
You're born with it.
Yeah. Now that you're over there, Andy, do you get that itch to hit people with sticks and steal their carpets? Do you not find yourself looking longingly at their natural resources, then catching yourself and saying, "Naughty, Andy. No, those are naughty thoughts."
Well, sometimes, you know, once you've shot the elephant, what are you going to do? You can't eat it all on your own, can you? So I guess you've just got to, you know, try and make a piano out of it and, a tarpaulin or whatever. So, you know, you've just got to try and blend in. And I certainly think that me, with my incredibly white skin and my stupid red balding head, blended in pretty seamlessly in Dhaka, Bangladesh. I mean, no one really spotted I was there, just wandering around the streets. No one, you know, with my hat on. No one. No, just blended in.
Just another local dude.
Yep, that's right. I thought, I was not at school with you. Oh, no. So, it's been amazing. It's been absolutely amazing. And I can heartily recommend Dhaka as a holiday destination, which I'd say 2 weeks ago, I would never have said that. And anyway, but more about that in our travel feature section later. This is Bugle 145 for the week beginning Monday, the 28th of February 2011, meaning it is now 400 years to the day since Swiss King Olaf the Weird inadvertently discovered skiing by slipping over whilst doing a drunken Saturday morning dance, landing with his feet on two commemorative longboats and sliding 1 kilometre down the side of a mountain, shouting, I meant to do this, stop laughing at me or I'll chop your nuts off. And if the court artist could put his paintbrush down, I'd be grateful. Bugle 145 million. There have now been as many bugles as there were different flavours of ice cream at John the Baptist's 5th birthday party. Indecisive kid, indulgent parents, waste of money as well. He just ended up pouring water all over them.
Top story this week, unrest update. Libby, yikes! When we last spoke to you, the Middle East was as wobbly as a jelly on a jackhammer. Egypt and Tunisia had already overthrown their governments and revolution fever was spreading. Now, incidentally, revolution fever is a little like scarlet fever in that hopefully you feel a lot stronger once you're out the other side, presuming that is that you're still alive. But it turns out that the "we're not going to take this shit anymore" bug that's sweeping the region has proved extremely contagious. Yemen and Bahrain have both caught it, and this week Libya has come down with a serious case of "f*** this shit." The difference with Libya is clearly the leader in question, because Colonel Gaddafi is a lunatic. Mubarak was an arsehole, but he wasn't an idiot. Fundamentally, he knew that the game was up, even if he took a few extra days for that to sink in. Ben Ali of Tunisia was a turbo douche, but he was also a realist. He knew when he had to step aside. Gaddafi, however, is a different matter. Here, you're dealing with a grade-A psychopath, so it's much harder to predict what someone so psychotically irrational is going to do. And it does seem that he's currently not going to give up power with anything less than something resembling the final scene from Scarface. Coked up, sweating, a bloated mess of the man he once was, screaming, "Say hello to my little friend!" as he unloads a gun indiscriminately from a balcony before being shot to pieces.
He claimed today, I understand, that he was, quote, like the Queen.
I saw that.
It's just, I guess, an unusual way to try and swing your public behind you. You know, just by confusing them. Saying, I am like the Queen of England. Right? Hang on, I'll just put this brick down and think about that for a second. But I guess when you think about it, John, he's very like the Queen of England, certainly from my point of view, in that I didn't vote for him. I don't particularly want his son to be King of England. And also, I think he's not as big as he was in the 1980s. The Queen, literally so, she's 4'8" now. She was 5'11" in 1987, and then Prince Philip did a magic course, and he tried the sawing the woman in half trick without having attended the last class, and as a result, the Queen is now a titch. But it's a bit embarrassing, John, when we look at this now, and, you know, Colonel Gaddafi did make that seamless transition that we've talked about before between major world terrorist and lunatic to invaluable trade partner with quite alarming smoothness. And, it gets even worse. In 2009, the countries of the European Union sold Libya €343 billion worth of arms, or adult fireworks, as they're now officially known, for tax and health and safety purposes. But it's important to remember that, you know, we might have sold Colonel Gaddafi these weapons, but we did ask very, very nicely for him not to use them. Yes. I mean, really, we can't entirely be held responsible for the fact that he's now turning them on his own people. Also, we have to remember that, you know, we might have sold him €343 billion worth of arms in a single calendar year, but at the same time, we in Europe will do absolutely anything within our power to further the causes of peace and democracy. Now, can you have both of those things, John? Is that like trying to have a pickled onion and a gherkin in the same sandwich?
Possible, not advisable. It's true, we very clearly put not to be used for naughty reasons on the invoice at the bottom in small print of all of those arms deals. It does seem that Gaddafi has lost control of the majority of Libya now, but he is clinging to control in Tripoli like a toddler clinging to a bug, trying to stop their parents from prying their hand open and taking the probably already dead insect away from them, screaming, "If I can't have it, no one can." And we've spoken over the last few weeks about how every dictator has their own way of leaving office. Ben Ali headed for Euro Disney with gold bars in his luggage. Mubarak scheduled a speech that everyone expected to be an announcement of his departure, only to fake everyone out, speak for 20 minutes about how great he was, and blueballing 500,000 people in Tahrir Square before taking a helicopter to the beach in disgrace a couple of days later. So, what has Gaddafi gone with? Well, true to form, it's been a sequence of increasingly erratic and dangerous appearances. At the start of the week, he appeared on state TV, talking to cameras out of a car door. A car, incidentally, so tiny that you expected 15 clowns to climb out after him. holding an umbrella and saying that he was on his way to speak to the protesters in Tripoli, but couldn't now because it was raining. And That's a pretty solid excuse, Andy. Your country's on the brink of a bloody civil war. You have only one chance to try and calm people down, but, oh, hold on, will you? Look at those clouds. There is no point getting your hat wet. That's just making a bad situation worse. He made that appearance to counter rumours that he'd already fled Tripoli. He then delivered another speech, standing in front of the ruined garden shed that was his family home when it was struck by American missiles in an attempt to kill him back in 1986. And at times, the camera panned up to show a towering gold-coloured monument in front of the building, showing a fist crushing a fighter jet with an American flag on it, having caught it mid-air. And I would not be surprised if that was something that Gaddafi honestly thinks that he did. Yeah, that's right. I caught a fighter jet with my bare hands and then I crushed it into dust. I can also catch tanks with my teeth and shit out their rockets like fireworks. Isn't that right, everyone? Yeah, sure you can, Colonel. We'll get to work on that tank statue too, shall we?
He did another televised address, John. I don't know if you saw it here. Where he just sang "Here Comes the Hot Stepper" for about 20 minutes, unbroken. Well, I guess that made his point. You know, he forcefully made his point.
I guess he's the hot stepper in that analogy, yeah. Isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, he's got hot steps. Fair play.
I don't think anyone would dare to deny
Libyan
that.
He's five-time ballroom dancing champion.
He was shouting through the rambling speech, declaring himself a warrior, and proclaimed, "Libya wants glory. Libya wants to be the pinnacle at the pinnacle of the world." Now, come on, Colonel. Libya might want that, but Libya can't have that, can it? You've got to set yourself realistic goals. Otherwise, it's no wonder you're so f***ing angry all the time. That's the problem, Gaddafi. Your outfits are writing checks that your GDP can't cash. Now, the weird thing was that it gradually became clear during this speech that Gaddafi was actually speaking alone from behind a podium in a deserted lobby with absolutely no audience in front of him. And it really did look like the ravings of a madman. There's a scene in Scorsese's film King of Comedy where Rupert Pupkin has a late-night talk show set up in his living room and does a whole show on his own pretending everyone else is there. And as he's doing it, you realise he's clinically... Yeah, you realise he's clinically insane. And that is what this felt like. That Gaddafi was just some weird guy pretending to be a dictator giving a speech to his terrified nation. You had to keep reminding yourself that he actually was one. He closed the speech saying, "I'm a fighter, a revolutionary from tents. I will die as a martyr at the end. I have not yet ordered the use of force, nor yet ordered one bullet to be fired. When I do, everything will burn." So, you know, extending the olive branch at the end there, albeit an olive branch that was wrapped around a massive machete.
So Bangladeshi just took an awesome catch running in.
Now, look, we should probably point out this is going to be an occupational hazard of the Bugle over the next month or so.
They're my new team. Bangladesh! Bangladesh!
It's good, Andy, that even in the face of the... a majority of the Middle East starting to go up in flames and calling for full revolution, you can still be distracted by cricket. I think that shows your love of cricket in a way that nothing else ever could.
Well, the thing is, John, you know, Bangladesh as a country has had its problems. It's taken a battering over the years from history and from nature. And now, through the vehicle of cricket, it is emerging as a bold, proud new nation. And maybe this could be the way for Libya. We just need to sit Colonel Gaddafi down with a video of the 1981 Ashes series and just watch him turn into a changed man. That's all I'm saying.
Well, we haven't tried it yet, but I would argue that is a bit of a stretch.
No, I mean, all we've tried is giving him weapons, and that just doesn't seem to have worked. And Italy is leading the European League of giving weapons to Libya. Italy sold them €112 billion worth. Now, Italy...
Oh, boy.
Silvio Berlusconi, you know, if he isn't banging underage girls, he's selling arms to nutcases. And yet they still vote the f***er in. What is wrong with these people? Yes, you can cook, but you need to pay more attention to the rest of your lives. But who was Berlusconi trying to impress with? $112 billion. I mean, it is an odd way of pulling hot young chicks. No, but it seems to work for him. Hey, sweet cheeks, let me tell you about myself. I just sold $100 billion worth of weapons to a tyrannical despot. Yeah, I sure did. Now do you want to see my plums? He must have some real personal job to pull that off. Germany sold £53 billion euros worth of military kit, mostly stuff used to jam communications. So well done them for facilitating the democratisation of Libya. But however this revolution pans out, John, when you look at these figures, I fully expect it to end with millions and millions of anti-Gaddafi Libyans standing on the coast of North Africa, looking towards Europe with their hands on their hips, shaking their heads, and then slowly and deliberately extending millions of middle fingers.
It'll be hard to argue with their rights and justification to do that. All of these speeches were followed yesterday by a phone call from Gaddafi to state television. So, a phone call, not perhaps exactly reassuring people that he was still in the country. I was waiting to hear a pilot's announcement in the background of the phone call telling everyone that they were first in line for departure and that the in-flight movie was going to be Alvin and the Chipmunks. during the phone call, Gaddafi changed tack, moving from blaming America and the Western media for interfering, and instead blaming Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, saying that they'd been giving young Libyans hallucinogenic pills in their coffee to get them to revolt, saying they are exploiting teenagers, giving them hallucinogens in their coffee with milk, like Nescafe. Wait, what? So Al-Qaeda can't even give them real coffee? They have to cheat them with the instant shit. You see, that's the problem with these extremists, Andy. They offer you paradise for all eternity, but all they're really giving you is instant fucking coffee.
Yeah, whereas the Italians have given them 50 billion euros worth of high-quality Lavazza espresso coffee. He also said, I call on the people of Libya to get out of their houses and confront this bunch of people. If they're not brave enough to go out and face this enemy on the streets, maybe they should let their women and their daughters go out. And this is the last refuge. When a dictator's in trouble, he starts basically calling his people sissies. Then you know he is fighting a losing battle.
As you mentioned, he likened himself to the Queen in the phone call, saying that he did not have any real authority and was only really a symbolic leader with ceremonial powers, saying, and I quote, I have no power. It's the people themselves who have the prerogative. To which the Queen replied, what, mate? Oh, I got no power, have I? Watch this. And then kicked a footman in the balls. Oh, got no power? Look at him. What's he going to do? Nothing. Because I'm the f***ing queen, mate. Come over here and say I've got no power. I'll shun you at a lavish steak dinner. Try telling me I got no power after that, asshole. He also pointed out that the queen had ruled for longer than he had not yet been overthrown. But I would say, in the queen's defence, she has not tortured or murdered anyone in that time. Well, I say,
really?
Certainly she's not in double figures. I know that if she tried anything like that, then I believe we've got a spike in the Tower of London with her name on it. And I've got to say, the argument that Gaddafi has no powers must ring a little hollow to the people in Tripoli that have spent all week being shot at, running around saying, oh, I don't know, Colonel, that felt like a legitimately powerful bullet that just whizzed past my ear. And am I to believe that my cousin was only ceremonially beaten to death in the streets yesterday? The response from America has been measured, with no call from President Obama for Gaddafi to step down. Instead, condemnation of the violence, saying that it is outrageous and it is unacceptable, before directing his administration to prepare a full range of options, including possible sanctions that could freeze the assets and ban travel to the US by Libyan officials. Now, whereas the response by the American government in Egypt was inexplicably slow, this time it makes total sense, due to the fact that there are hundreds of American citizens still stuck in Tripoli, and Gaddafi is comfortably crazy enough to round them up and execute them in the street if he felt he was being slighted. And the very fact that this is a universally held concern does throw into question exactly how reformed he was when we started dealing with him again in 2003.
Another question that arises, John, is, in all this, where is the voluptuous blonde Ukrainian nurse?
Yes, true.
As revealed by WikiLeaks, because she seems to be the only one keeping him in power, keeping him on the straight and narrow, as we've discussed before. She seemed to turn him from this nutcase into the valuable trade partner when she came on the scene. Sources close to the voluptuous blonde Ukrainian nurse have suggested that her voluptuous left wang thinks Colonel Gaddafi should get out while he still can, while her voluptuous right grank scribbler thinks that he should fight to the bitter end. So I guess, you know, it just depends what bra she happens to put on the day.
Gaddafi is nothing if he is not demonstrably insane. From his rambling speeches, memorably going through two translators in his speech to the UN a while ago after one gave up exhausted, to his idiosyncratic costume choices, resembling a mid-period Michael Jackson with a dash of Jean-Paul Gaultier and a sprinkling of Busta Rhymes, to his very name himself. He spells it about 14 different ways and has awarded himself the title Kings of Kings of Africa, Guide of the 1st of September Great Revolution of the Socialist People's Libyan Arab Jamihara, and the Brotherly Leader and Guide of the Revolution. He is the master of reinventing his image. He's like Puff Daddy or Madonna, Andy. When you've been in power for as long as he has, you have to keep reinventing yourself so that you stay relevant and people don't get bored. Now, is he crazy? It's hard to say, but I can't conclusively say that he hasn't at some point written the word Gaddafi in his own feces on a hotel room wall. Now, I can't say that he has done that either, but I definitely can't say that he hasn't.
You've written Gaddafi on the wall. I've never stayed in a hotel room with you without waking up to Gaddafi and your shit on the wall.
And he has more reason to do it than I have. Now, let me just put it this way. He's either an international pop singer who has lost all sense of perspective, or a clinically diagnosed schizophrenic. And, while I would not be qualified to say which is which, I would definitely say that I don't seem to own any of his albums. And if he'd made any, I definitely would. Perhaps the strongest condemnation of Gaddafi, surprisingly, came from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who said this, quote, and I hope you're sitting down. He said, and I quote, "It is unimaginable that there is someone who is able to kill and bombard his own people. This is very grotesque. I strongly advise them to let nations have their say and meet their nations' demands if they claim to be the officials of those nations, if they consider themselves the ruler of those countries and nations. How is it possible that a ruler opens fire with machine guns, tanks and cannons on his own people? How can a ruler bombard his own people and then say, I will kill anyone who opposes me? This is absolutely unacceptable. They should let nations' wills take effect. Freedom, national sovereignty, deciding about their own fates, enjoying dignity and respect are the rights of nations. I think the whole world was appalled at what happened in Libya. It was very bad behaviour. And I hope they make up for that and meet their people's demands. Of course, anyone who does not heed the demands of his own nation's will have a clear fate." I can only imagine that Ahmadinejad then held his gaze with the camera, counted 3 seconds in his head, 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi, and then the entire room fell about laughing. Oh, God! Oh, God, did you get that? Did you get that? Because I really nearly lost it halfway through there. I could see you starting to go behind the camera, and the sound guy was starting to shake the boom. He was laughing so hard. Kill his entire family, by the way. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Kill just half of them. Kill just half of them. I have to send a message. When Ahmadinejad hangs you out to dry, you are on your own. There is no lonelier situation for a dictator to be in. I'm sure Gaddafi is somewhere right now, watching the rain roll down the plastic window of one of his Bedouin tents, matching the tear that is rolling down his leathery cheek, whispering, "Why, Mahmoud? Why?"
Is it possible with Ahmadinejad's speech, John, that...
Yeah.
I mean, did the camera pan down? I mean, it seems to me what probably happened here is there was a bet on, and he almost certainly had he had a bet that he could not give a 5-minute speech with his wang out. And the only way he could do it was by delivering a speech so monumentally out of character that people didn't even notice that his willy was out. Is that, I mean, do we know that that did not happen?
That could be true. I can't remember. That could be true. I was too busy looking at his face in incredulity. He might have done it, and he might have pulled it off.
Either that, or he has changed tack when it comes to hiring speechwriters.
It's like Anchorman. It turns out he's like Ron Burgundy. He will read anything that's in the prompter. That was the prank version of Go F*** Yourself, San Diego. Gaddafi really is like a clinical experiment in what happens if no one disagrees with you for 40 years. If no one says, don't wear that, you end up looking like he does. If no one says, shut the fuck up, you end up giving speeches like he does. And if no one says, that looks tacky, you end up with a 25-foot gold statue of a fist crushing an American plane in your back garden.
So by this time next week, we have to predict, will it be Libya or Libna? I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Silvio Berlusconi news now, and, well, he's being charged. Since we last did a bugle, he's been officially charged with being very, very naughty indeed. But this is the latest in his spectacular 17 years in and out of power. Allegations of wild sex parties, prostitution, bribery, tax evasion, corruption, and much, much more. And yet, the polls show that his public approval rating is still high, and if an election were to be held tomorrow, he would win it.
Amazing.
What do these people want, John?
Amazing.
The thing is, prostitution, he's been accused of paying for sex with a 17-year-old Moroccan exotic dancer. He's called the charges groundless. And the thing is, prostitution is not illegal in Italy, and the age of consent is 14, but a prostitute must be 18 or older. So in Berlusconi's defence, he might be a 75-year-old man banging a 17-year-old, but legally it's just a technicality. Leave the man alone, let him live his own life. And also, he's been accused of abusing his office. The alleged prostitute was arrested for an unrelated theft, and charges were filed against Berlusconi because he used his political position to secure her release. Now, he claims, the excuse for this is that he believed the girl was related to Hosni Mubarak. He was simply attempting to avoid an international diplomatic incident. Yep. I mean, that, John, that is the obvious excuse. I know, you know, whenever I get in trouble, that is my first port of call. When I was caught shoplifting a cream bun from a bakery in Addis Ababa back in 1992, my first reaction was to say, it's for Hosni Mubarak, this cream bun. He loves cream buns. I know Lee Harvey Oswald. His initial defence was, I thought JFK was Hosni Mubarak, and I was trying to shoot a mosquito off his shoulder. Bernie Madoff says, I thought maybe if I made loads of money, I could help Hosni Mubarak build a pyramid for himself. You know, we've all got our Hosni Mubarak excuses, John, and it just shows that Berlusconi is human. These are Berlusconi's excuses, amongst many, but like shoppers milling around a clothes store on the first day of a new All Our Clothes Are Made of Fish Skin promotion in the middle of summer, people simply aren't buying it. Boom!
That is a solid joke all the way from Bangalore, India, Andy.
That sure is. That might be the most contrived simile in the history of Bangalore.
Leadership birthday news now, and while we're talking about psychotic despots, it seems only fair to mention that Robert Mugabe turned 87 years old this week. Apparently he credits his longevity to eating lots of vegetables, getting lots of sleep, and the insatiable bloodlust that has kept him driven to commit countless atrocities on his own people. I think most people would love to be able to follow a health regime like that, Andy, but where's the time? Despite the rising tension in his country, and it seems that even tension now is subject to mass inflation there, Mugabe was shown on state television blowing out candles and sharing a cake with family members and staff. And a bit of a letdown, the cake, Andy, because it would have been a lot more fitting if he was seen shooting the candles instead, or sitting back as the candles were gradually tortured until their flames finally went out. That would have been a much more thoughtful cake for the birthday boy, and you have to believe that someone is going to be in big trouble for not providing that for him. On this happy, happy day, Andy, I thought it might be a fitting tribute to remember a classic Mugabe quote. This is something he once infamously said. He said, "I'm still the Hitler of the time. This Hitler has only one objective, justice for his people, sovereignty for his people, recognition of the independence of his people and their rights over their resources. If that is Hitler, then let me be Hitler tenfold, 10 times. That is what I stand for." What can you say, Andy, to someone who thinks that Hitler would have been a better leader by being 9 times more Hitlery? That's a bold theory, and one that I don't believe I've heard before, even from some of the most visceral neo-Nazis. So, many, many happy returns to the Zimbabwean despot, and allow me to personally send him a ceremonial 87 f*** yous from the rest of the planet. Uganda news now, and the president of Uganda, President Museveni, says he might release an album after a rap that he performed became a smash hit on Uganda's radio stations and in its nightclubs. The leader, nicknamed M7, performed 2 children's folk chants from his birthplace in western Uganda at several election rallies over the last few months. Natama Akami, translated, "I cut a stick," and Mpenkoni, translated as "Give me the stick." He also recorded Ndeke, translated as "Check out my stick, mother." Nkome Mpanati, translated as "Biggest stick you'll ever saw," and Mpale Mpale, "Bitches love when the stick come out." There are already criticisms. There are already criticisms that the album promotes stick violence among young people in Uganda. And record producers then, this is true, apparently mixed the performances with hip-hop beats and audio of Museveni talking to the crowd about a genre of music that he said was new to him. He said, and I quote, "Today, these young people taught me about this rap. I was not following what they were saying. Well, I can give you some rap myself, he says, before launching into a rhythmic rendition of the chants in his distinctly gravelly voice. The song was titled, I promise this is true, You Want Another Rap? After a question, Museveni shouted to crowds of young people and quickly appeared for sale. I've got to tell you, Andy, he needs to get some hype men in there now who will join in on every fifth word of his speeches. Because Uganda already has the institutionalised homophobia that is rife in much of hip-hop, unfortunately. So Uganda really are well on their way to being a nation-state version of Death Row Records.
Google feature section now and travel. And since we last spoke, John, I have skipped the country 3 times. I'm a fugitive from the law, albeit on a pre-planned itinerary and without the law having any real beef with me, and hence not devoting any resources to tracking me down. I initially fled Britain for Dubai. I was turfed out of Dubai after 36 hours, as scheduled. All I could get at the airport was a flight to Bangladesh, possibly because that is the flight I booked for myself. And then after 3 days in Dhaka, I was forced to peg it to India due to a contractual agreement with Cricinfo and a desire to watch some more cricket. Since then, I've been ducking and diving, never staying in one place for more than a couple of days. That's how they find you. Down the paper trail of hotel and travel bookings, I guess. Delhi, Nagpur, back to Delhi, and now Bangalore. And in a change from the traditional British tradition, I have thus far managed not to shoot any tigers or subjugate the locals and exploit their natural resources for my own personal gain. So well done, me. Just shows what a modern, enlightened man I am, John. So here's my Bugle travel guide to some of the places I've been so far. Dubai. As discussed previously in this esteemed journalistic organ that is the Bugle, Dubai is a silly place, the world's biggest and most expensive toy. The highlight of Dubai, other than the departure lounge at the airport, was the Burj Khalifa, the world's tallest and f***ing stupidest building. And John, it is properly staggering. It is majestic, physics-defying, a half-mile-high shard of pure economic cock and architectural wang flops onto the table of humanity, to the sound of oil-rich billionaires saying, what do you think of this, my dears? It is a startling marvel of engineering, a thing of sky-popping, eye-scraping beauty in its own way, a honkingly amplified f*** you to the concept of impossibility, a bejeweled middle finger glittering defiantly in the face of gravity, necessity, and reason. A statement that there is nothing that is beyond the reach of humanity if the part of humanity making it is prepared to spend billions of dollars it doesn't have on something it doesn't need, while shafting other parts of humanity hard and persistently in the arse with a solid gold truncheon. And the Burj Khalifa, John, is undeniably magnificent and certifiably f***ing stupid. There are, however, a lot of buildings in Dubai that are not nearly as magnificent and even more f***ing stupid. Because since the world economic downturn kebabs the bubble of blind idiocy that drove the Dubai building boom like Juan Pablo Montoya driving a jet-propelled mobility scooter, there are, as a result of this, hundreds of tower blocks with basically no one in. Now, Dubai, and you can't help thinking, particularly when you go to Dhaka afterwards, could that money not have been better spent doing something else than building a pointless skyscraper?
No, for a long time, obviously not.
For a long time, Dubai has had more money than sense, by a similar margin to how millipedes have more legs than tits, or how the Bodleian Library has more books than inflatable blimps in the shape of Crocodile Dundee style at Linda Kozlowski. Dubai had more money than sense. But then the money turned out to be pretend, but the unquenchable lack of sense remained. And this is the Dubai we have today. So these f***ing stupid islands in the shape of the world are sitting f***ing stupidly, sinking even more stupidly into a suitably embarrassed sea. Skyscrapers are one or both as empty and unfinished, standing in sheepish uselessness, gathering sand and dust. As necessary as pogo sticks for kangaroos, rucksacks for goldfish, or zero-gravity snooker tables for starving sub-Saharan children. As Albert Fizzwiz Einstein himself said, you cannot put a lead on a headless dog. Sorry, that's the wrong quote. He also says, an ostrich in a catapult is not the same as a helicopter. No, sorry, that was Thomas Edison. But anyway, Einstein said that the difference between genius and stupidity is that genius has its limits. And if he'd been to see the Burj Khalifa, and if he'd seen, like I did last week in Dubai, 2 ice hockey teams full of Russians playing each other in a game in a shopping mall in a desert, if he'd seen a hotel with a helipad where a room for a night could feed a village for a year, he would be patting himself on his back with his magic test tube saying, nice one, Albert, you have hit that nail bang on the bonce. Now, Dhaka next, John. No one would mistake Dhaka for Paris. It doesn't have quite the same array of chic designer clothes outlets. No one would mistake Dhaka for Los Angeles. Its film industry is much less prominent. And even fewer people would mistake Dhaka for Dubai. Dubai, a place with about as much soul as a bombed-out Kabul fishmonger. Dhaka, a ceaseless wave of humanity clinging to the precipice of viability, with its triumphs and tragedies bustling together. And last week, John, it was going stark, bonkers crazy for cricket. And at the end of this week's Bugle, to show you quite how stark, bonkers crazy for cricket they were going, we've got some audio of the crowd at the opening World Cup match in Dhaka during an over in which the Indian bowler Srishant conceded 24 runs. Now, for our American listeners, that is f***ing shit. And the crowd went absolutely ballistic. And he said, if you like sport, if you like cricket, you'll love it. If you like sport, you'll love it. If you like life, you will love it. And that's coming at the end of the podcast. And the World Cup began in Dhaka last Saturday. There was an opening ceremony featuring, well, can you guess who it featured, John? I mean, who would you obviously book for the opening ceremony of a cricket tournament in Bangladesh?
There's only one person, Andy, and her name is Tina Turner.
Wrong. It's Bryan Adams. So, close. But, you know, he's all about cricket in Bangladesh. You know, if you play Summer of 69 backwards, it's basically a paean to the Bangladesh Test captain, Habibul Bashar, who is retired now. Anyway, I arrived in Dhaka just as the opening ceremony was finishing, and my first experience of Asia was a taxi ride through streets that were blistering with enthusiasm for basically the biggest international event in the country's history. And the people I met, you know, it's a country of massive and obvious poverty, but the people I met at the cricket grounds in the streets were proud and optimistic and incredibly welcoming in the face of this long-term battering from history and nature. I couldn't help but thinking, London needs to lighten the f*** up. And going from Dubai to Dhaka is like playing consecutive frames of snooker against Kim Kardashian and Mother Teresa. So it was an eye-opening experience. I've met some really charming Indian cricket journalists, and some of them have got a flight from India into Bangladesh, had to fill out an entry form, an immigration form, in which they had to say colour of skin, black, white or medium.
What?
That was on the Bangladeshi entry form, the immigration form. Black,
medium.
White or medium.
Yeah. I'm guessing that was a form that was designed by the British years ago.
And then I went to Delhi, and I went to a game in Delhi, and some of you might have read about the Delhi police being a little over-officious and essentially starving the stadium close to the point of death by not letting any food in. And they were confiscating pretty much everything, and I was searched on the way in, and they wanted all my coins, because they have had a bit of crowd trouble in Delhi in the past. And they searched my wallet for coins. But interestingly, I had to give them my Indian rupees, but I was allowed to keep my British pounds. I don't know if that's good or bad for Britain, if it just means no one would possibly throw a British pound. It is an honourable currency, it always has been and always will be. Or it's just that Britain's currency has fallen so low in the esteem of the world that people think it's not worth being collected for charity as the rupees were, and also it's so embarrassing to its owner that no one would consider throwing it as a missile in a public location. Well, if you want to keep up with my journey around Asia, then it's on Crick Info. Also, my World Cricket podcast is back via iTunes and also via the Zaltzman on the Road page on Crick Info. Also, my cricket Twitter feed, full of more bullshit than the sport of cricket has ever endured before, is Zaltz Cricket. And there's the Hello Buglers Twitter feed with occasional updates as well. So, thanks for listening, Buglers. Next week, we'll have another new country. I'll be even closer to the equator. In Sri Lanka.
Yes, that's it. So, well, continue having a spectacular time, Andy.
Thanks. I will. It'll be, it's me and cricket and Asia. And it was meant to be, John. It was meant to be.
The Zaltzman Empire Tour 2011 continues.
I'll bring you all back some tusks.
Bye, Buglers.
Bye-bye.
out of here.